The Life of an American Jew in Racist Marxist Israel, written in 1985 by Jack Bernstein. A challenge. The contents of this book are expected to bring a strong reaction from the Zionist Jews. I am well aware of the tactics of you, my Zionist brethren, used to quiet anyone who attempts to expose any of your subversive acts. If the person is a Gentile, you cry, "You're anti-Semitic," which is nothing more than a smokescreen to hide your actions. But, if a Jew is the person doing the exposing, you resort to other tactics. First, you ignore the charges, hoping the information will not be given widespread distribution. If the information starts reaching too many people, you ridicule the information and the persons giving the information. If that doesn't work, your next step is character assassination. If the author or speaker hasn't been involved in sufficient scandal, you are adept at fabricating scandal against the person or persons. If none of these are effective, you are known to resort to physical attacks. But, never do you try to prove the information wrong. So, before you start your efforts to quiet me, I offer this challenge. You Zionists, assemble a number of Zionist Jews and witnesses to support your position, and I will assemble a like number of anti-Zionist, pro-American Jews and witnesses. Then, the Zionists and the anti-Zionists will state their position and debate the material in this book as well as related material, the debate to be held on public television. Let's explore the information and let the American people decide for themselves if the information is true or false. Isn't that a fair challenge? Certainly, you will willingly accept the challenge if what I have written is false. But, if you resort to crying, lies, all lies, and refuse to debate the material, you will, in effect, be telling the American people that what I have written are the true facts. Jack Bernstein. This honest and courageous Jew was assassinated some years ago, by Mossad. My Farewell to Israel, Thorn of the Middle East, by Jack Bernstein. Before Israel became a state in 1948, Jews worldwide were filled with Zionist propaganda that Israel would be a homeland for all Jews, a refuge for persecuted Jews, a democratic country and the fulfillment of biblical prophecy. I am an Ashkenazi Jew who spent the first 25 years of my life in the United States, the country that has given all Jews freedom and the opportunity to prosper, and prosper we Jews did, to the point that one portion of the Jews, the Zionists, have gained a position of political and economic dominance in the US. To fully understand the story I am about to tell, it is important that you understand what Zionism really is. Zionist propaganda has led the American people to believe that Zionism and Judaism are one and the same and that they are religious in nature. This is a blatant lie. Judaism is a religion, but Zionism is a political movement started mainly by East European, Ashkenazi, Jews who for centuries have been the main force behind communism/socialism. The ultimate goal of the Zionists is one world government under the control of the Zionists and the Zionist-oriented Jewish international bankers. Communism/socialism are merely tools to help them accomplish their goal. I was a victim of Zionist propaganda. After the 1967 war, we Jews were filled with pride that our homeland had become so powerful and successful. Then too, we had been filled with the false propaganda that Jews in America were being persecuted. So, between 1967 and 1970, approximately 50,000 American Jews fell for this Zionist propaganda and migrated to Israel. I was one of those suckers. After being filled with all this false Zionist propaganda, I felt that I would have a better chance to succeed in the new Jewish state. There was an added enticement, the spirit and challenge of pioneering and of helping my fellow Jews. Dual citizenship. I had no emotional conflict with leaving the US, because I was still able to keep my US citizenship and could return to the US at any time. You see, Jews are allowed to be citizens of both Israel and some countries, U.S. is one of those countries. The U.S. government allows a Jew to be a citizen of both U.S. and Israel. German Americans cannot be citizens of both the U.S. and Germany. Italian Americans cannot be citizen of both U.S. and Italy. Egyptian Americans cannot be citizens of both the U.S. and Egypt. But, a Jewish American can be a citizen of both Israel and the U.S. This is a good example of the power the Zionist Jews have over the U.S. government. I arrive in their Jewish paradise before leaving for Israel. A Jewish friend of mine had made arrangements for me to stay a few days with her sister, Fawzia Deboul, and her spinster aunt. After arriving at Lod Airport just outside of Tel Aviv, I took a bus to the home of Miss Deboul and her aunt. When I saw Fawzia, it was love at first sight. I started calling her Ziva, her Hebrew name. Ziva is a Sephardic Jewess from Iraq who, like myself, had fallen for the Zionist propaganda and had migrated to Israel. She was employed as a hairdresser. The kibbutz. After visiting with Ziva and her aunt for 2 days, I left to spend 6 months at Kibbutz Ein Hasof, at one of the well over 150 such communes then operating in Israel. Since then, many more have been started, especially in the territory taken from the Palestinian Arabs. A kibbutz is a farming and sometimes industrial venture. It is important to explain that Israel's kibbutz system is a Marxist idea brought to Israel by the Ashkenazi Jews who migrated to Israel mainly from Poland and Russia. These Jews are part of that bunch of Jews known as the Bolsheviks. Before 1917, they were the force that laid the foundation for the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917 in Russia and the start of communism. Again, I want to point out, even emphasize, that it is some of that same bunch of Ashkenazi, communist/socialist Jews who migrated to Israel, gained control of the Zionist movement and have dominated the government of Israel since its beginning in 1948. Now, back to the kibbutz. Prior to 1967, most of the work on the kibbutz was done by Jews. But, since the 1967 war, the work has been done by Arabs who are paid a very low wage, and by volunteers from overseas. Members of the kibbutz, all Jews, share all things equally. They receive clothing, food and a small allowance. All profits from the venture go into the kibbutz account for future use. Each of these kibbutz are affiliated with one of Israel's Marxist parties, ranging from socialist to hardcore communist. The kibbutz I was in was not hardcore communist. Yet, I was happy to leave after 4 months, 2 months earlier than originally planned. During the time I was working in the kibbutz, I carried on courtship with Ziva. She was one of the reasons I left the kibbutz after only 4 months. We were to be married. Our marriage created problems. The marriage ceremony was held in the Sephardic synagogue. The ceremony was simple but beautiful. Ziva and I were happy, but our marriage created serious problems. You see, Ziva is a Sephardic Jewess and I am an Ashkenazi Jew. For an Ashkenazi Jew to marry a Sephardic Jew is frowned upon in Israel by the ruling Ashkenazis. To understand why this is the case, you must realize the difference between the Sephardic and Ashkenazi Jews. The powerful Zionist propaganda machine has led the American people to believe that a Jew is a Jew, one race of people, and that they are God's chosen people. I will deal with the God's chosen people lie later. First, it is important for you to understand that Jews are not one race of people. There are two distinct groups of Jews in the world and they come from two different areas of the world, the Sephardic Jews from the Middle East and North Africa and the Ashkenazi Jews come from Eastern Europe. The Sephardic is the oldest group and it is they, if any, who are the Jews described in the Bible because they lived in the area described in the Bible. They are blood relatives to the Arabs. The only difference between them is their religion. The Ashkenazi Jews, who now comprise 90% of the Jews in the world, had a rather strange beginning. According to historians, many of them Jewish, the Ashkenazi Jews came into existence about 1,200 years ago. It happened this way. At the eastern edge of Europe, there lived a tribe of people known as the Khazars. About the year 740 AD, the Khazar king and his court decided they should adopt a religion for their people. So, representatives of the three major religions, Christianity, Islam and Judaism, were invited to present their religious doctrines. The Khazars chose Judaism, but it wasn't for religious reasons. If the Khazars had chosen Islam, they would have angered the strong Christian world. If they had chosen Christianity, they would have angered the strong Islamic world. So, they played it safe, they chose Judaism. It wasn't for religious reasons the Khazars chose Judaism, it was for political reasons. Sometime during the 13th century, the Khazars were driven from their land and they migrated westward, with most of them settling in Poland and Russia. These Khazars are now known as Ashkenazi Jews. Because these Khazar Ashkenazi Jews merely chose Judaism, they are not really Jews, at least not blood Jews. Throughout their history, these Polish and Russian Ashkenazi Jews practiced communism/socialism and worked to have their ideas implemented in these countries. By the late 1800s, significant numbers of these communist/socialist Jews were found in Germany, the Balkans and eventually all over Europe. Because of their interference in the social and governmental affairs of Russia, they became the target of persecution by the Tsars. Because of this, migration of these communist/socialist-oriented Jews began. Some went to Palestine, some to Central and South America, and a large number of them came to the US. Political Zionism is born. In 1897, the first Zionist Congress was held in Basel, Switzerland. At this Congress, it was decided to work toward the establishment of a Jewish state, and a search for land on which to build this Jewish state began. Great Britain offered the Zionists land in Africa. This the Zionists rejected, they wanted Palestine. At the time, Palestine was inhabited by 500,000 Palestinian Arabs and a few Palestinian Jews who were blood related and who had lived together in peace for centuries. With Palestine as their choice for a homeland, European Ashkenazi Jews began migrating to Palestine. As I explained earlier, most were communist/socialist oriented, with some of them being radical Bolshevik communists whose aim is world domination. So when you think of Jews, especially as related to Israel, keep in mind that there is a great difference between Sephardic and Ashkenazi Jews. They are not one united people. They are divided socially, politically and especially racially. Now, back to Ziva, a Sephardic Jewess and I an Ashkenazi Jew, and our lives in the so-called democratic country of Israel. Sephardic Jews, second-class citizens. For the first 3 years of our marriage, it was necessary for us to live with Ziva's aunt. This was because of the critical housing shortage in Israel and because of racism. Housing is allotted as follows. Ashkenazi Jews who have lived in Israel for many years are given first choice. Second in line are Ashkenazi Jews from Europe, especially if they are married or marry an Israel-born Ashkenazi Jew. The next favored are Ashkenazi Jews from the US, especially if they marry an Israeli-born Ashkenazi. Sephardic Jews have the next choice of whatever housing is left. At the bottom of the list are Muslims, Druze and Christians. Opportunities for employment follow the same pattern. Ashkenazi Jews get the choicest jobs, Sephardic Jews next, and Muslim, Druze and Christians fill the menial jobs, with a great many left unemployed. Even though I was an Ashkenazi Jew from the US, I was placed lower on the list for housing because I married a Sephardic Jewess. Being denied housing was my second experience of the intense racism that exists in Israel. From the very beginning of my arrival in Israel, many slurs were yelled at me. We American Jews were merely being tolerated. Because Israel, to survive, must depend on gifts of American Jews and the sale of worthless Israeli bonds in America. There is jealousy among the elite Israeli Ashkenazi Jews toward American Jews, even if the American Jews are also Ashkenazi. Many times I was told, go home, and, we want your money, but not you. However, there was a portion of the American Jews who were welcome and given favored treatment. They were the card-carrying communist Jews. Of the 50,000 American Jews who, like myself, had migrated to Israel between 1967 and 1970, about 20%, 10,000, of them were Marxist-oriented, with a great number of them actual card-carrying communists. They were welcomed by the Israeli authorities and local Ashkenazi and were given favored treatment, housing, jobs and social life. It must be noted, besides coming from the US, a great number of communist Jews were migrating to Israel from Chile, Argentina and South Africa. Of the 50,000 who had migrated to Israel during that time, 80% of us eventually returned to the US. The 20% who remained were those who were card-carrying communist or sympathetic to Marxism. Three faces of Israel. From what I have told you so far, you must have the idea that Israel is a Marxist, socialist/communist country. This would be correct. But, Israel has three faces: communism, fascism and democracy. The Ashkenazi Jews who migrated to Israel from Russia brought with them the ideology of socialism/communism and have put into practice much of that ideology. The Ashkenazi Jews who migrated to Israel from Germany, while sympathetic to communism and support it, tend to favor the practices of Nazi-style fascism. During World War II, in Germany, these elite Zionist Ashkenazi Jews worked closely with Hitler's Gestapo in persecuting the lower-class German Jews and delivering them to concentration camps. Now living in Israel, these elite Zionist Jews, who were well trained in Nazi-style fascism and favor it, have imposed many facets of fascism on Israel. To give the impression that Israel is a democracy, members of the Knesset, Israel Congress, are elected, an odd type of election. This is where Israel's so-called democracy stops. It doesn't make any difference which party wins an election, the Likud or Labor, the elite Zionist Jews rule in a dictatorial manner, giving favors to the elite clique and brutally suppressing any dissent. In the Zionist/communist scheme of world domination, it is Israel's role to continually stir up trouble in the Middle East. Since wars are a big part of this scheme of aggression, it is only natural that from early childhood on, Israeli youth are trained mentally and physically for war. For instance, Israel has its equivalent of Hitler's youth group. It is the Gadna, and all high school and junior high students are required to participate, boys and girls. Like Hitler's youth group, the youth in Israel's Gadna are dressed in khaki uniforms. They take training and engage in paramilitary exercises. Even at play, guns and thoughts of war are present. When on a picnic, instead of taking along baseball or soccer equipment, they take submachine guns and assault rifles and practice shooting and playing military games. Once graduated from high school, all young boys are required to serve 3 years in the army, 2 years for girls, or 4 years in the Navy or Air Force, 3 for girls. Ultra-Orthodox religious Jews are exempt from military service. Once out of the service, a number of the ex-service people join the Shin Bet, the equivalent of Hitler's Gestapo. Like the Gestapo, they engage in repressing anyone who acts or speaks out against the Marxist/fascist government of Zionist-dominated Israel. Like in Nazi Germany, all people in Israel are required to carry identity booklets called Tudat Zot in Hebrew. One day I changed jackets and forgot to take out my ID booklet when I went downtown in Tel Aviv. A police officer approached me and asked for my Tudat Zot. I told him I had left it in my other jacket. Because I didn't have my ID booklet with me, I was taken to the police station. At the police station, the desk sergeant informed me that for not having my ID booklet with me, I could be jailed for up to 16 days without even being taken before a judge. All that was necessary is for the police lieutenant to sign ICE remand order. I asked permission to make a telephone call to my wife and tell her to bring my ID booklet to the station. The sergeant allowed me 2 hours to have my DUI produced. I called my wife and she brought my DUI, arriving just minutes before the 2-hour deadline expired. If she had been late in arriving, I would have been jailed for 16 days for not having my ID booklet with me. This is just one indication that Israel is a police state and not a democracy. Concerning Nazism/fascism, please let me clear a point. Germans are an admirable people, I dare say even great. But in Germany, the general population were victims of the Nazis who through cunning and brutality gained power. In Germany, the average Jews were victims of the Zionist elite who worked hand in hand with the Nazis. Many of those same Zionist Jews who, in Germany, had worked with the Nazis, came to Israel and joined hands with the Zionist/Communist Jews from Poland and Russia. It is the two faces of communism and Nazi-style fascism that rule Israel. Democracy is merely an illusion. Regarding the tie between the elite Ashkenazi Jew and the Nazis, take a look at the word Ashkenazi, look again Ashkenazi. Interesting, isn't it? There is a great confusion regarding the relationship of fascism to communism. Fascism is national socialism. Communism is international socialism. Israel's economy. Economically, Israel is bankrupt. Of course, this could have been predicted because Israel's economic structure is based on socialism. Whenever a government of a state and its citizens spend more money than the value of the goods produced, economic bankruptcy will result. If it were not for aid from America, Israel's economy would have collapsed long ago. Israel is a welfare state in every sense of the word. It is America's most favored welfare recipient. While America's farmers, small businessmen and laborers are struggling to survive, the U.S. government, dominated by Zionist Jews, are draining the pockets and purses of American taxpayers to support Israel's socialist economy and war machine. Since the Israeli government knows, and the favored Zionists know, that the Zionist pressure in America will ensure that America will keep sending them massive amounts of money, Israel's government and its favored citizens spend money like drunken sailors. This practice leads to inflation and eventually to an economic collapse. Comparing Israel to drunken sailors is unfair to sailors. Sailors spend their own money, Israel spends money it gets from America. Because Israel is a welfare state depending mainly on American aid for survival, it is on a downhill slide. In 1982, Israel's inflation rate was 130%. In 1983, it was 200%, and this year, 1984, it is expected to exceed 400%. That means a hamburger that cost $1 last January will have risen to $5 by the end of December. History shows that no nation mired in economic problems as Israel has become, has ever avoided an economic collapse. Only with a massive increase in American financial aid can an economic collapse be averted. Even then, this solution would only be temporary. Regarding the destructive tendencies of socialism, there are circumstances that allow a country to successfully provide social programs to help its people. It is possible in a country that has sufficient financial resource and where its citizens are deeply religious and considerate toward their fellow men. None of this exists in Israel. Even in countries where conditions are ideal, there lingers a danger. Since the government of the country provides for the needs of its citizens, most of these citizens have a tendency to lose incentive to work hard, and a country with a complacent citizenry is easily conquered. Visitors to Israel. Tourism is one of Israel's main sources of income. The largest group of visitors are American Jews. But, There are also many American Christians who want to visit the holy shrines and to see the land of God's chosen people. These Christians come away very impressed and filled with religious fervor. While in Israel, Jews and Gentiles alike are carefully watched so that they do not stray and happen to see the sordid side of Israel, the true Israel. Like in Soviet Russia and other communist countries, visitors to Israel are taken on carefully planned guided tours. They are shown the religious sites, the universities, the lush orchards, the technical accomplishments, the arts, and to stir sympathy, they are taken to visit the Holocaust Museum. But, kept from the eyes of the tourists are the ghettos, the prisons where political prisoners, mostly Arabs and Sephardic Jews, are subjected to the most inhumane forms of torture. The tourists do not see the widespread crime activities and the corruption and cooperation between organized crime bosses and government and police officials. The tourists do not learn of the true inner workings of Israel's Marxist/fascist government, nor do they see Israel's racism. I met one American tourist who couldn't help telling me about the wonderful religious feeling she had from being in Israel, the Holy Land. I remarked to her, "Just try giving a Bible to a local Jew and you will see how much religion and religious freedom there is in Israel. If seen by the police, you will be arrested." Regarding the Holocaust Museum, I cannot help but comment, the Holocaust may not have happened, if their Zionist leadership in Germany had not cooperated with the Nazis. 2. If the Zionists, worldwide, had not persuaded various countries to refuse to accept Jews from Germany. The Zionists in America persuaded President Roosevelt to shut the door and not allow Jewish refugees into America before the war when there was still a chance for Jews to leave Germany. It must be added that many people, including Jews, question whether the Holocaust happened as portrayed by the Zionist propagandists, at least not to the extent the Zionists claim. Religion. The land on which the present state of Israel has been built, formerly Palestine, was once walked upon by Moses, Jesus and Muhammad. Since Palestine was the site of many religious events and has many religious sites, it is rightfully referred to as the Holy Land. So, one would think that Palestine, now Israel, would tend to have an air of holiness about it. When Palestinian Muslims and Palestinian Jews occupied Palestine, there was a religious aura. But, since their Zionists took over the area and set up the State of Israel, it is one of the most sinful nations in the world where only 5% of the Jews are religious. It is interesting to note that those who are strongly religious are Arab Muslims and Arab Christians who make up a small minority in Israel. Israeli laws suppress all religion. For instance, it is against the law to try and convert a Jew to another religion even if the Jew is an atheist or humanist. A Christian is permitted to preach the gospel in a church building, but for the clergy or anyone to even tell one about teachings in the Bible outside the church building will bring a 5 years prison sentence. For a Christian to give a Bible or religious article to a Jew will also bring a 5 years sentence. Even an act of kindness by a Christian toward a Jew, such as giving a gift of food, can be interpreted as trying to convert the Jew to Christianity and can bring a 5 year prison sentence. This same law of religious suppression applies to those of the Islamic faith who in an act of kindness give a gift of any kind to a Jew. A 5 year prison sentence can result. The treatment of religious Jews is touchy for the ruling Zionists. Worldwide, Jews and non-Jews view Israel as a land where Jews may practice their religion without persecution. Therefore, the Zionists do not dare risk suppressing Judaism for fear of arousing world opinion against them. So, the ruling Zionists merely tolerate the religious practices of the small minority of religious Jews in Israel. God's chosen people. The American people have been led to believe that Jews are God's chosen people. This myth was started by a small group of Jews. A few Jewish leaders took excerpts from the Bible and interpreted them as chosen people. But, Isn't it odd that it is not the religious Jews who claim to be God's chosen people? It is the atheistic non-believing Jews who claim that honor. Leading the cry, "We are God's chosen people," are the Zionist/Marxist, Ashkenazi, Jews who for political purposes chose Judaism and who don't have a drop of biblical Jewish blood in them. One Israeli religious Jew said it well: "At one time we Jews were chosen by God to be his messengers. But, long ago we forfeited that right." Anyone who has read the Bible with an open mind knows that God gave Jews of that time special favors. But, it was in the form of covenants. In these covenants were conditions. The conditions were that God demanded the Jews obey his word. Time after time the Jews broke the covenants. They rejected God and turned to adoring mammon. It doesn't take a biblical scholar to realize that long ago even the real Jews lost the right of being God's chosen people. In comparing the degree to which the followers of the three major religions practice their beliefs, I make this observation. Judaism, few Jews, Sephardic or Ashkenazi, are religious. This is true in America, in Israel and worldwide. Christianity, the Christian's religion, has felt the influence of Jewish meddling and infiltration, especially in America, resulting in confusion and bickering between the various Christian denominations. This has led to a lukewarm attitude among most Christians toward their religion. There is evidence to prove that Jews, or one of their many fronts, have started many of the Christian denominations and thus dominate doctrine. Islam, Muslims, who follow the teachings of Islam, are by far the most fervent of the three major religions in following their religious beliefs. The Judeo-Christian ethic we hear so much about in America is a big joke, the result of an intense Zionist propaganda campaign. I'll toss in one last thought about the God's chosen people myth. God said, "Beware of those who call themselves Jews and are not, for they lie." Could it be the Ashkenazi Jews are the people to whom God was referring? Israel stirs perpetual war. In the Holy Land, it would seem that there would be peace. Instead, war and preparation for war is ever present. The Israeli military machine is recognized as the fourth most powerful in the world. From the standpoint of the amount of planes, tanks and other fighting equipment, plus the fact that it is of the latest design, does make the military machine of Israel very powerful. But, in the army, serious weaknesses have developed. Before exploring the weaknesses of Israel's army, let's briefly review each of the wars in which Israel has been involved, an average of one every 8 years, since it became a state in 1948. 1948 war, just after Israel had declared itself a state, Palestinians and other Arabs attacked the Israeli army which had been formed out of the terrorist groups, the Agon and Stem Gang. The reason for the attack by Palestinians was to try and regain their homes which, through murder and terrorism, the Zionists had confiscated. The Palestinians had been a peaceful people and were not trained in the art of warfare, while the Ashkenazi Zionist Jews who had migrated from Soviet Russia, Poland and Germany had more knowledge of tactical warfare. In addition, Zionists had built up a large amount of arms which they had purchased from the US and communist countries and had illegally smuggled into the area. The Arabs were defeated and in the process, Israel conquered more Palestinian territory. 1956, Egypt owned the land through which the Suez Canal flows. Egypt's President Nasser declared his intention of taking over operation of the canal from England. This would have hurt England's colonial empire. So, England along with France and Israel conspired to attack Egypt. With Egypt nearly subdued, America's President Eisenhower stepped in and ordered England, France and Israel to withdraw. At the time, the United States was still militarily strong enough to back Eisenhower's order, so England, France and Israel did withdraw. This was the only time during U.S.-Israeli relations that a U.S. president put the interests of America ahead of Israel's interest. 1967 war, tension was mounting between Egypt and Israel over territory located between the two countries, the Sinai and Gaza Strip. 1967 war, tension was mounting between Egypt and Israel over territory located between the two countries, the Sinai and Gaza Strip. Map of Greater Israel. Greater Israel. To help Israel get an unfair advantage, the Soviet Union resorted to trickery. Soviet diplomats in Egypt told President Nasser to threaten war but not attack. Then Soviet diplomats told Israel's leaders to threaten war and then go ahead and attack. This act of treachery enabled Israel to attack while Egypt was off guard and destroy Egypt's military capacity in 6 days. It has been the goal of Israel's leaders to take over all the land between the Nile and Euphrates rivers. Besides the Sinai and Gaza Strip, which Israel intended to take from Egypt during the war, they desired the West Bank, which was part of Jordan, and the Golan Heights, which was part of Syria. So during the 1967 war, Israel resorted to trickery. Israel had the technical equipment to intercept radio messages and change these messages, boil them, and then send them on to their destination. During the war, Israel intercepted messages from Egypt to Jordan and Syria and changed the messages, tricking Jordan and Syria into entering the war. The Arab countries were defeated and Israel took a big step toward its goal of conquest by occupying the Golan Heights and the West Bank as well as the Sinai and Gaza Strip. Even though Israel's attack on Egypt is called the 1967 war and often referred to as the Six-Day War, it can hardly be called a war. Egypt, the most powerful Arab nation at that time, didn't have a chance to fight. Trickery on the part of the Soviet Union and Israel, as I have explained, rendered the so-called 1967 war nothing more than a treacherous act of terrorism for which the Soviets and Israel are famous. Israel's attack on the USS Liberty. During the 1967 war, one of the most daring acts of treachery was committed. It was the attack on an American ship, the USS Liberty, by America's so-called friend, Israel. During Israel's treacherous attack on Egypt, the USS Liberty, an American surveillance ship, was cruising off the coast of Israel monitoring the progress of the attack. Realizing the USS Liberty was learning and recording Israel's acts of treachery, Israeli leaders decided to get rid of the evidence. Israeli planes and torpedo boats attacked Liberty with the obvious intent of sinking it. If the ship was sunk, thus destroying the evidence, Israel then could blame Egypt for the attack, and their Zionist-controlled news media in America would have given the lie as fact with the intent of turning the American people against Egypt. But, fortunately, bravery on the part of the Liberty crew kept the ship afloat. Israel failed in its act of treachery against America, its ally, but during the attack, Israel killed 34 crew members of the Liberty and wounded 171. Israel claimed the attack on the Liberty was a case of mistaken identity. But, reports by the surviving crew and other evidence prove the attack by Israel was intentional. Facts about the attack on the USS Liberty were conveniently omitted by the Zionist-controlled American news media. All that the Zionists told the American people was that Israel had sunk an American ship, but that it was a case of mistaken identity. An investigation by the U.S. government was subdued and the matter quickly forgotten. This is a good example of the tremendous influence the Zionists have over the U.S. government. The cover-up of the whole scandalous affair by the U.S. government could not have succeeded if the news media had done its duty and reported the facts surrounding the attack. It is a good example of the power the Zionist-controlled news media in America to distort or withhold important news from the American people. 1973 war, the treachery on the part of Israel and the Soviets that led to the 1967 war embittered the Arab people, and immediately they began arming with the intent of retaliating for this Israeli treachery and to try and take back the land that Israel had taken from them. By 1973 they were prepared. Even though several Arab countries were preparing militarily, they were trying to peacefully work out a solution with Israel. But Israel was assured that their Zionist brethren in America would use their power over the U.S. government to make sure that the U.S. would support Israel. So, Israel's leaders continued to maintain a belligerent attitude. Realizing the hopelessness of further negotiating with Israel's leaders, Egypt along with Jordan, Syria and Iraq attacked Israel, and they were winning. With Israel facing defeat, the powerful Zionists in America pulled the strings of their power over the U.S. government, and the U.S. government officials obeyed their Zionist masters. Massive amounts of U.S. military equipment and arms were airlifted at taxpayers' expense to Israel to bolster the retreating Israeli forces. This U.S. aid enabled Israel to turn the tide and emerge victorious. Yes, Israel was salved, but so much U.S. military equipment was airlifted to Israel at that time that the U.S. armed forces were left in short supply and in a weakened position. U.S. government officials are so much under the influence of the Zionists that they had alerted the 82nd Airborne Division stationed at Fort Bragg, NC, and U.S. troops stationed in Germany for the purpose of being sent to aid Israel, if necessary. It is pretty sad that to please their Zionist power in America, U.S. government officials are willing to sacrifice the lives of American boys to save Zionist/Marxist Israel. Young men already in the U.S. armed forces and their parents, grandparents, brothers and sisters should especially be concerned about Israeli precipitated wars and attempts to involve the U.S. in these wars, because if necessary, to save Israel in one of their acts of aggression, the U.S. government will bow to the American Zionists and send American boys into combat. The boys will have no choice but fight on the side of Zionist/Marxist Israel. If American boys die in a future Mideast war, you will know that those responsible will be the Zionist Jews of America and the weak-spined politicians in Washington, D.C., who bow to their Zionist lords. New York/Moscow/Tel Aviv Triangle. At this point, you may be confused. Israel and the Soviets are ideological allies, both follow the ideas of Karl Marx, so both are communist/socialist. Yet, the Soviets supplied military equipment to the Arabs, Israel's enemies, and at the same time, the Soviet Union's enemy, the United States, was arming Israel. To understand the treachery which Zionist/Bolshevik Jews are capable, and to understand the treachery which took place before and during the 1973 war, I must explain the New York/Moscow/Tel Aviv Triangle. To do so, it is necessary to go back a few years in history. A heavy migration of Jews from Russia to America started in 1831. Most of these were communist Jews. So many of these communist/Bolshevik Jews settled in New York City that New York has been referred to as Moscow on the Hudson. It has been pointed out, and with good reason, that decisions regarding communist policies come not from Moscow, but from New York City. Whether this is a fact or not is immaterial. What is important is the fact that there is a close tie between the Zionist/Bolshevik Jews in New York City and their Zionist/Bolshevik Jews in Moscow, and extending to include their Zionist/Bolshevik Jews who dominate Israel's government. The Zionist power over the U.S. government in Washington, D.C. stems from the Zionist/Bolsheviks centered in New York City. It is from New York that orders go out to the vast Zionist network all over the U.S., a network that influences the economic and political affairs of not only our federal government, but nearly all, if not all, state governments, and to a great extent the governments of the larger and even medium-sized cities. This power of the Zionist/Bolshevik Jews over the U.S. makes the New York leg of the New York/Moscow/Tel Aviv triangle a tremendous influence over communist policies. In viewing the 1973 war, most people, and it seems most Arabs, are of the impression that since Soviet Russia sold equipment to Egypt and other Arab countries, the Soviets were in support of the Arabs in the 1973 war. This is a false impression. To understand that this is the result of more deceit on the part of Israel and the Soviet Union, you must be aware of the Goldemir-Stalin/Kaganovich Pact. Goldemir had been born in Russia, grew up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and in 1921 migrated to Israel. In 1949, Goldemir became Israel's first ambassador to the Soviet Union. Representing Israel, Ambassador Goldemir, a Bolshevik Jew, met with two representatives of the Soviet Union, Kaganovich, a Bolshevik Jew, and Stalin, who had married the Bolshevik Jew. They made a secret agreement, a pact. Israel's part of the pact was: 1. Israel would not allow any Western country, especially the U.S., to build military bases on Israeli territory. 2. Israel would allow an official Communist Party to function freely in Israel. 3. Israel would not make any agreement to solve the Palestinian problem. 4. Israel would influence world Jewry, especially in the U.S., to have Western powers adopt a policy of favoring Israel over the Arabs. 5. Israel was to continue its Marxist economic policies and prevent any free enterprise tendencies. Soviet Union's part of the pact was: 1. The Soviets would institute a pro-Arab policy solely as a camouflage for its true intention, which was to furnish aid to the Arabs, but never enough to enable the Arabs to destroy Israel. 2. The Soviets would open the gates of Soviet satellite countries to Jewish immigration to Israel. Should this be insufficient, Soviet Russia then would open its own gates to immigration. 3. The Soviets would absolutely guarantee the security of Israel. Both the Soviet Union and Israel would exchange intelligence reports. From the terms of this pact, you can see it was, and still is, the aim of the Soviet Union and Zionist/Marxist Israel to prevent peace between the Arab countries and Israel until all the Arab countries are forced to adopt socialism under Soviet leadership. In the conduct of the 1973 war, you can see part of this deceitful agreement being utilized, in particular the part about the Soviet Union helping the Arabs, but not helping enough to defeat Israel. In planning the 1967 war, Israel was aware that the Arab countries bordering Israel were buying equipment from the Soviets, an Israeli ally. But, because of the Goldemir-Stalin/Kaganovich Pact, Israeli leaders knew the Soviets would not help the Arabs enough to defeat Israel, that the aid the Soviets were giving the Arabs was only bait to draw the Arab countries into the Soviet trap. Also, Israeli leaders knew that their American Zionist brethren were making sure the U.S. government was supplying enough arms to stop the Arabs, and would send more equipment, even troops if necessary. When the 1973 war started, Jordan, Egypt, Syria, and Iraq surprised Israel with their improved fighting capability. The Egyptian army faced what would seem an impossible task in its attempt to penetrate Israeli territory. First, there was the water barrier, the Suez Canal, to cross. Then, they would face a high wall of sand and fine dust which was erected by Israel. Behind that wall was a third barrier, a line of Israeli fortifications. These fortifications were stronger than the Maginot Line erected by France before World War II to stop any German invasion of France. Yet, by ingenuity, the Egyptian army crossed the Suez Canal, went over the sand and dust barrier, and broke through the heavy fortifications in a matter of a few hours. Israel was in trouble, the Arabs were winning the war. But, as pre-planned, if necessary, the U.S. airlifted huge amounts of military equipment and supplies to Israel and, as I mentioned before, the U.S. Airborne Division at Foot, Bragg, N.C., and U.S. troops stationed in Germany were placed on alert and would have been sent to help the Israeli forces if it became necessary to help Israel win the war. Fortunately for America, American troops weren't needed to help Israel survive. The additional arms were enough. However, the Arab forces were strong enough to stop Israel from taking over more Arab land. In fact, Egypt was able to take back part of the Sinai. Egypt's president Sadat realized that the Soviets had no intention of helping the Arabs win the war, that the Soviets in selling them some equipment were only trying to trap Egypt in the Soviet net. So, Sadat kicked Soviet military advisors and civilian technicians out of Egypt. 1982 Invasion of Lebanon. In Israel, most Jews have become tired of Israel's involvement in war and aggressive acts and want peace. It is only the communist faction that wants war. Sadly, it is these communists who are in power in Israel. The 1982 attack into Lebanon by Israel further divided the Jewish population of Israel. Even within the more militant Zionist Jews, there is a split. The reason given by Israeli leaders for the attack into Lebanon was to root out the Palestine Liberation Army, PLO, and stop their terrorist attacks into Israel. Many Israelis have dared speak out and condemn this reason as false. They have pointed out that in an effort to achieve peace with Israel, the PLO had for 11 months refrained from making any attacks on Israel. The real reasons for Israel's attack Lebanon were, and still are, according to the latest headlines. 1. It is the intention of Israel's Zionist/Marxist leaders to carry on perpetual war. The attack into Lebanon was merely another phase of Israel's wars of aggression policy. 2. Water is scarce in the Mideast, especially in Israel. Ever since Israel became a state, it has wanted the waters of the Litani River for use in Israel, and the only way they could get it was to go in and take it militarily. Israeli leaders and the general population figured the war would last only a few days. But, the Palestinians and other Arabs fought heroically against the Israeli invaders who had far superior equipment. As the months passed without victory, and as more Israeli soldiers were brought home and buried, dissent within Israel spread. In the Israeli military forces, many members resigned or refused to carry out orders because it would have meant killing innocent civilians. The death of the 250 Marines serving in Lebanon has been blamed on the Arabs. This is as it had been reported by the Zionist-controlled news media in America. But, this has not been proven. In fact, reliable reports coming out of Lebanon indicate the terrorist attack on the American Marine base was planned by Israeli military personnel or the Mossad, Israel's secret service. In that case, who actually carried out the attack is immaterial. Israeli personnel planned and instigated the attack. It is common practice for the Zionist/Marxists to plan a covert act and then get someone else to do the dirty work. By instigating the attack on the Marine base, the Israeli war hawks had hoped the attack would turn the American people against the Arabs and that America could be drawn into the war and further help Israel in its aggression against the Arabs. Fortunately, the American people didn't fall for the trap. A good example of how the Zionists will commit an act of terrorism with the thought of someone else being blamed is the Levin affair. In 1954, a group of Israelis set off a series of bombings of American institutions in Egypt, including the American embassy. They expected that Egypt would be blamed for the bombings and cause a break in U.S.-Egyptian relations. Fortunately, Egyptian authorities caught the Israeli agents in the act of setting one of the bombs, and the whole Israeli plot was exposed. Most Americans are not aware of the treacherous Levin affair because the Zionist-controlled U.S. news media failed to report it, just as they failed to report the facts surrounding the Israeli shelling of the USS Liberty. When will Israel stir up another war? 1985, 1986. It is difficult to predict, but it is certain that Israel will cause another war unless the American people learn the truth about Zionist/Marxist Israel and act to stop the politicians in Washington from bowing to the American Zionists and stop using American taxpayers' money to finance Israel's war machine. Weakness in Israel's military. There is no doubt that Israel has a powerful military force. The base of Israel's military power is the massive amounts of the latest equipment supplied by the US and paid for by the American taxpayers. But serious weaknesses have developed in Israel's military. It is in the makeup of the personnel that weaknesses emerge. This is due to two main reasons. 1. Because Israel has continuously been involved in war or preparing for war, the cream of Israel's youth are leaving Israel or they find some excuse to not serve in the armed forces. The Israeli army is so short of manpower that it is openly recruiting homosexuals, of which Israel has an abundant supply. In 1976, an Israeli army officer testifying before the Knesset, Israel's Congress, said in effect, "If we do not recruit homosexuals, we will not have enough manpower to fill the ranks." Also, it has been learned that Israel has had to resort to hiring foreign mercenaries, paid fighters. 2. Another weak point is the growing ill feeling between Ashkenazi Jews and Sephardic Jews in the Israeli army. This has developed because nearly all the officers are Ashkenazi Jews and most of the lower ranks who must do the fighting are Sephardic Jews. Due to the shabby treatment of Sephardic Jews by the Ashkenazi Jews in the army, a mutiny by Sephardic Jews is a strong possibility. A warning to Mr., Mrs. and Miss America. The Marxist Zionists who rule Israel and the Marxist Zionists in America have been trying to trick the US into a Mideast war, on the side of Israel, of course. They almost succeeded when US Marines were sent to Lebanon in 1982. The blood of the 250 American Marines who died in Lebanon is dripping from the hands of the Israeli and American Zionists. If more Americans are not made aware of the truth about Zionist/Marxist Israel, you can be sure that, sooner or later, these atheists who claim to be God's chosen people will trick the US into a Mideast war against the Arabs, who in the past have always been America's best friends. Then, more American boys will die because of these clever murderous Zionists, who, incidentally, have been responsible for pushing America into World War I, World War II, the Korean War and the Vietnam War. While Zionist international bankers and other Zionist Jews were busy counting their profits from those wars, American mothers and fathers, brothers and sisters were mourning the loss of their sons and brothers. Will you someday be mourning the loss of your son or brother, because of Zionist treachery? Crime in Israel. Since Israel, formerly Palestine, is the land where Jesus and Muhammad once walked, it would seem the inhabitants of this land would have respect for this holy land and for the religious sites that exist. Nearly all Arab Muslims and Arab Christians do have respect, even reverence, toward the holiness of the land, but only a small minority of the Jews have this same respect. 95% of the Jewish population are atheists or secular humanists and are not held back by the Ten Commandments or other restraints on sinful human behavior. When the Zionist/Bolshevik Jews won control of the Holy Land, every form of sin began seeping into this land. Within a few short decades, this Holy Land became a modern-day Sodom and Gomorrah. Drug trade, drug abuse, illegal weapons sales, prostitution, gambling, labor racketeering, murder, extortion, blackmail, insurance fraud, loan sharking and corruption of government officials and police. Israel has a highly organized crime syndicate headquartered in Bat Yam near Tel Aviv. Many members of the crime syndicate are ex-convicts and ex-commandos from the Israeli army, and they are highly skilled in the use of weapons and explosives. The crime syndicate in Israel operates openly because of corruption in government and police circles. Some of the police and government officials are actively associated with the crime operation. The average American doesn't hear of this, the real side of Israel, because the Zionist-controlled press, radio and TV in America keeps silent about it. But, in Israel, some newspapers report the facts. For instance, right in the middle of page one of the Hebrew language newspapers a couple of years ago was an article that said, in effect, what the Italian mafia couldn't accomplish in 40 years, the Israeli mafia accomplished in 5 years. It has developed the largest illegal drug exporting ring in the Mideast, selling drugs mainly to Germany and the US. They have even set up a distribution network within Germany and the US. Except for a few religious Jews who have emotional religious ties to the holy sites in Israel, and lower class Jews who can't afford to leave, all other decent Jews have left or are planning to leave. One big reason is this: impermeating virtually every phase of Israeli society is too much for decent Jews to endure. Israel's arms industry. Since terrorism, violence and war are a way of life in Israel, it is only natural that manufacturing of military equipment and arms has become Israel's main industry and export. During the first few years of its existence, Israel acquired its military needs from the US and from communist countries. But, gradually with US assistance, Israel developed its own arms industry. Zionist domination of the US government has led to an Israel first policy. This Israel first policy has severely hurt the US economy. Instead of manufacturing certain military materials in the US and thus provide jobs for American workers, factories were set up in Israel with US financing and technical assistance to manufacture these products. The US has also helped Israel set up factories to produce electronic equipment, pharmaceuticals, chemicals, home appliances, etc., all products that could have been produced in the US. While Israel profits from these Help Israel ventures, American workers are left standing in unemployment lines. Manufacturing of certain war materials has become so great that it has become Israel's main export. This war-creating country, which has been portrayed as the only barrier to communism in the Mideast, sell its war products to anyone who has the money, including repressive dictatorships, fascist or communist. Israel not only sells weapons made in Israel, but also sells weapons supplied to Israel by the US. It has been discovered that some weapons used by Soviet forces in Afghanistan were made in America and originally shipped to Israel. Also, it has been learned that some weapons used by Cuban forces in Angola were made in America and originally shipped to Israel. It is ironic that the United States is in a life and death struggle against the spread of communism. Yet, our Zionist-dominated US government allows military equipment to be shipped to communist forces via Israel. Israel's racist policies. You will recall that I mentioned my troubles in Israel began when I, an Ashkenazi Jew, married a Sephardic Jewess. Anti-Sephardic treatment by Ashkenazi Jews is even official government policy. This racism runs very deep in Israel and sharply divides the Jewish population. One day, I entered a cafe in Tel Aviv. The place was crowded and I sat down on the only seat available. Also sitting at this table were 5 Sephardic Jews from Morocco. They learned that I was studying the Hebrew language, so they were helping me with my studies when a blue-eyed, Nazi-type Israeli police officer walked into the cafe. He ordered me to get away from those kushim. Kushim in Hebrew means niggers, I replied, after I finish eating. The officer drew his service revolver and said, "You move now. You had better listen to him," the cafe owner advised. So, I got up. Standing close to me The officer pointed his gun right at my face and ordered, "Throw your coffee and pastry on the floor." With a gun pointed at me, I didn't argue, I threw the coffee and pastry on the floor. Then he said, "Get out of here and don't come back." Later, I learned that I was lucky. He could have arrested me if he had wished, and he could have even shot me under vague Israeli laws. In the US, if anyone complains of police brutality or misconduct, there is an investigation, but not in Israel. The person registering a complaint can expect police reprisal in the form of a beating. Besides being denied decent housing and decent employment because I was married to a Sephardic Jew, I was the target of racial slurs. Several times I was even attacked by Ashkenazi Jews because I had married a Sephardic Jew. Other American Ashkenazi who had gone to Israel and married Sephardic Jews received the same treatment as I. Because Sephardic Jews are victims of the racist practices against them, I had often heard, in Israel, a Sephardic Jew tell a European Ashkenazi Jew, "Hitler didn't kill enough of you bastards." Please read the next paragraph carefully. I was born in the United States, attended public schools, worked in various parts of the US, and served 2 years in the US Army. Not even once was I persecuted or had racist remarks made to me because I was a Jew. It is ironic that once in Israel, the so-called paradise for all Jews, I, a Jew, suffered because of racism. The Zionist-controlled news media in America has kept from the American people the news that Israel is intensely racist. Most Ashkenazi Jews in America are not aware of the racism in Israel. Even those Jews who have visited Israel are not aware because they are carefully kept from witnessing racist incidents. However, Sephardic Jews in America have spread the truth about the practice of racism against the Sephardic Jews in Israel. Knowing of this, Sephardic Jews have not been among those Jews who migrated to Israel from America. From what I have written so far, you should now realize that few Jews practice Judaism. Most Jews are atheists or they follow humanism, which is anti-God religion. So the portrayal that Jews are a religious people who look to Israel as a fulfillment of biblical prophecy is a myth. Also, the portrayal that Jews are one race of people is a myth. The Sephardic Jew, Ashkenazi Jew division is adequate proof. Racism as practiced in Israel is one reason that Israel will sooner or later destroy itself. Communism in Israel. The Zionist-controlled news media in the US has led the American people to believe that Israel is the only barrier holding back communism in the Mideast. This would be humorous if it did not have such serious implications for the United States. From what I have said so far, you should now realize that Israel is basically a Marxist country mixed with some Nazi-type fascism. A large book could be written about it, but for now I may only wish to add. 1. Israel is the only country in the Mideast that allows communist parties to operate. There are 3. Ironically, it is the Arab countries which forbid communist parties to operate. The exception is North Yemen, which, through treachery, was taken over by the communists. Some of the Arab countries buy military equipment from communist countries because they can't get enough from the US. To offset the huge amounts the US provides Israel. But, that's as far as any Arab/Soviet ties go. 2. The Soviet Union allows a good number of Jews to leave if they promise to go to Israel, and Israel welcomes these communist-oriented Jews. It must be noted that once out of the Soviet Union, many, if not most, Soviet Jews come to the US instead of going to Israel. It must also be noted that hundreds of thousands of Jews have left Israel since its founding. Some sources put the number at 1 million. Some of these Jews have requested to go back to the Soviet Union rather than live in Israel. Life for these Jews is better in Soviet Russia. 3. The latest scientific developments that the US provides Israel are channeled onto the Soviet Union. The main center through which this scientific information passes is Israel's Weizmann Institute in the town of Rehovot, about 40 kilometers south of Tel Aviv. 4. About one-third, 1/3, of the Knesset belong to one of Israel's communist, socialist or other Marxist-oriented parties. That should put to rest the lie about Israel being the only barrier against communism in the Mideast. In fact, it is the Arab countries that form the barrier that has stopped the spread of communism in the Mideast. Israel is one leg of the New York/Moscow/Tel Aviv triangle, which is behind the communist movement. Terrorism and violence. At the first Zionist Congress, which was held in 1897 in Basel, Switzerland, one of the goals set was to create a Jewish state in the land of Palestine. At that time, only a few Jews were living in Palestine, and they were nearly all native Sephardic Jews who are blood related to the Arabs. These Palestinian, Sephardic, Jews and the Palestinian Arabs were living in peace as they had for centuries. After the Zionist Congress in 1897, European Ashkenazi Jews began migrating to Palestine and buying land wherever they could. Yet, by 1920, Jews owned only 2% of Palestine. By 1948, when Israel declared itself a state, these invading Jews had increased their land ownership, but it was still less than 6%. To accommodate the increasing European Jewish migration, the Jews needed more lands, but the Palestinian Arabs refused to sell. So, to get more land from the Palestinians, these communist-oriented European, Ashkenazi, Jews resorted to the one thing at which they are adept: terrorism. Their first major act of terrorism against the Palestinians was at the Palestinian village of Deir Yassin. During the night of April 9, 1948, two Zionist terrorist gangs, the Airgun and the Stem Gang, attacked and massacred over 250 men, women and children. Menachem Begin, leader of the attack on Deir Yassin and later Prime Minister of Israel, has this to say: "The massacre was not only justified, but there would not have been a state of Israel without the victory at Deir Yassin. The massacre at Deir Yassin caused other Palestinians to flee their homes in fear. Zionist terrorists drove trucks with loudspeakers through the streets and over the roads of Palestine, warning Palestinians that what happened at Deir Yassin would happen to them if they didn't leave. These Zionist terrorists weren't bluffing, for example. They killed 60 Palestinians at Baladesh Sheikh. They blew up 20 homes in Sasser, killing 60 women and children. They killed a number of women who were working in St. Simon Monastery in Jerusalem. They massacred 250 at Lida. They killed 200, mostly old people, in the village mosque in Eddawaime. They killed 51 workers as they returned from their fields at Kafr Qasim. Christian inhabitants of Garba Birim were expelled from the village and the village destroyed. The village cemetery was desecrated, including the smashing of 73 crosses." During the few months when these and other acts of terrorism were taking place, 300,000 Palestinian Christians and Muslims were forced to leave their homes or be killed by the terrorist groups, which were made up of European, communist-oriented Jews. It was these same Marxist-oriented Jews who were soon to become the ruling elite of the State of Israel. From the beginning, and to the present, these terrorist Marxist-oriented Zionists have ruled Israel. After Israel declared itself a state on May 14, 1948, Israeli terrorism continued in an effort to push more Palestinians from their homes. Since 1948, 350 Christian churches and Muslim mosques have been destroyed by these Zionist terrorists. At this point, I wish to give this warning to all God-believing people in the United States: Christians, Muslims and Jews. The destruction of religion by the Zionist Jews is well underway in the US. In Israel, it has nearly been accomplished. Zionists eliminate opposition. To accomplish their goals, the Zionists will let no one stand in their way. During World War II, The Zionist leadership cooperated with the Nazis by delivering lower-class Jews to the concentration camps. So, it is not surprising that they sank the ship Patria carrying 252 Jewish immigrants who the Zionists feared may oppose Zionism. In another incident, 760 Jewish lives were lost when the Zionists sank the ship Struma for the same reason. Even well-known world figures are not immune to Zionist terrorism and violence. In 1948, in an effort to bring about a peaceful settlement in the Israeli/Palestinian area, United Nations sent Count Folkbimad of Sweden to mediate. Count Bimadov favored a partition of the area, a portion of the land for Jews, and a portion for Palestinians. This angered the Zionists who wanted all the land. In a brazen show of disregard for diplomacy, justice and common decency, the Zionists eliminated Count Bimadov. He and his driver were assassinated while riding down the streets of Jerusalem. Tens of millions of people have been killed since the Zionist/Bolshevik Jews, backed by the Zionist-oriented Jewish international bankers, took over Russia. In the Mideast, these same Zionist/Bolshevik Jews are using the very same tactic to root the Arabs from their land. They have killed untold thousands of Arabs and rendered hundreds of thousands homeless. The question arises, how many Arabs will they kill when the Zionist/Bolsheviks gain control over the Mideast and when they gain physical control over America? They already have control of nearly every phase of American life. If the Zionists ever succeed in imposing gun control on the American people, there will be nothing to stop them from complete takeover America. Disaster ahead. Ephraim Sivala, a Russian Jew, migrated to Israel in 1971. After 5 years of frustration in Israel, he left, as have nearly all other decent Jews. In his book, Farewell Israel, Sivala predicted that Israel would only last another 10 years. This he wrote in 1975. Israel's existence could drag on past 1985, but I agree with Sivala that Israel is doomed. Israel's Marxist/fascist policies, wars of aggression plus racism, has led Israel to the brink of disaster. In anticipation of Israel's collapse, corrupt Israeli leaders and other Jews in positions of power have already been charged with embezzling large amounts of American taxpayer money given to Israel and Jewish donations and deposited this money in foreign accounts. It must be kept in mind that because of Israel's policies, the free countries of the world have turned against Israel and against the US for supporting it. This has hurt Israel and especially the US. If Israel as it now exists simply collapsed and ceased to exist, the world would certainly be no better because of it. Unfortunately, the New York/Moscow/Tel Aviv triangle will not allow Israel to die quietly. As the collapse of Israel draws near, one of two courses of action by the New York/Moscow/Tel Aviv triangle is likely to be taken. 1. Israel could trigger a large-scale Mideast war, a large war which Israel could not win alone. Then the New York leg of the New York/Moscow/Tel Aviv triangle would use its influence on the U.S. government to send U.S. military forces to aid Israel. It isn't expected that the Moscow leg of the triangle will become militarily involved. Moscow will merely sit back and let the U.S. weaken itself in helping Israel fight the Arabs. At some point during the war, when the U.S. military is deeply involved and the U.S. citizens demoralized, the Zionist-oriented Jewish international bankers will make their move. Evidence leads to the conclusion that it is these bankers who own the class A stock of the U.S. Federal Reserve, America's central bank. In this position of power, these Zionist bankers can, and likely will, trigger an economic collapse in America, like they did in 1929 when they caused the stock market crash and started the severe depression of the 1930s. Since the money system currently used in the U.S. is not backed by gold, silver or anything of value, the paper dollars and tin coins now in use will be worthless. in the resulting state of confusion and in an effort to obtain food and other necessities, the American people will accept the new state's constitution which has already been written. This will place the American people under the dictates of one world government run by the Zionist-oriented international bankers and Zionist/Bolshevik Jews. Exactly what direction the war in the Mideast will take only the New York/Moscow/Tel Aviv triangle and God will know. When it is all over, the main losers will be the American people, the Arab people, the Sephardic Jews and that portion of Ashkenazi Jews who are for justice and freedom. The only winners will be the Zionist international bankers and their Zionist Bolshevik, communists/socialist, Jews. 2. The other likely course of action would be a backup, if the American taxpayers say, that's enough, the cost of supporting bankrupt Israel is draining increasing amounts of money from the American taxpayers. At some point, the taxpayers are going to say, that's enough. When that happens, the Moscow leg of the New York/Moscow/Tel Aviv triangle will move in to fill the void. To neutralize the United States, the Zionist international bankers will likely create an economic collapse and throw the U.S. into a state of chaos. What military action the Soviet Bolshevik Jews and the Israeli Zionist/Bolshevik Jews will take against the Arab countries only the triangle and God will know. It is likely they will strike into the Arab oil fields first. Whatever action is taken, one thing is certain, the losers will be the American people, the Arab people, the Sephardic Jews and that portion of the Ashkenazi Jews who are for justice and freedom. The only winners will be the Zionist international bankers and their Zionist/Bolshevik, communist/socialist, Jews. Based on developing military, economic and political actions in both the US and Israel, the two courses of action I have mentioned appear to be the most logical for the New York/Moscow/Tel Aviv triangle to follow. Whether one of the two develops, or whether a surprise is in store for us, only the Zionist/Bolshevik war lords and God know. This raises the question, what can we in America do to stop the New York/Moscow/Tel Aviv war lords? The stakes, freedom or slavery. In deciding the course of action to be taken to stop the Zionist/Bolshevik war lords, two points are the keys and must be restated and emphasized. 1. One leg of the Zionist/Bolshevik Jews is based in New York City. It was from this base that financial and organizational aid was given to carry out the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia. This revolution enabled the establishment of the second leg of the Zionist/Communist power, Moscow. If it were not for the continued support by the New York Zionist/Bolshevik Jews and their nationwide network, communism would have collapsed long ago. But the various facets of power held by these Zionists in America have enabled them to trick the American people into supporting communism. 2. Communism would not have gotten started and most problems faced by Americans would not have developed if the news media would have kept the American people informed about the actions of the Zionist/Bolsheviks. However, these Zionist/Bolshevik, communist, Jews are clever. Before they began their acts of a subversion in America, they gained control of the major newspapers and especially the news services which supply national and international news to the smaller daily newspapers. Since they controlled, and still control, the major news media outlets, including radio and television, they have been able to distort or omit the truth about their subversive acts. Exposure is the solution. In 1920, Henry Ford, S.R., wrote, "If the American people ever become aware of the truth about this coterie of Jews, it would be the solution." What Henry Ford meant was, if the American people ever learned the truth, they would take whatever action necessary to stop this bunch of Zionist/Bolshevik Jews. Many individuals and groups are in the process of trying to inform the American people about the danger they present to America and to the free world nations, but it is still far too little to be effective. It would be in the interest of nearly every person who is aware to quietly but energetically help to spread the information to others. People who have an interest would include the average American who wishes to preserve his or her freedom, Arab American who wish to remove the thorn of oppression in the Mideast, people from the captive nations of Europe who wish to rid their homelands of the Bolshevik scourge, Ethiopian Americans and other Afro-Americans who have seen their homelands taken over by these Bolshevik/communists, Chinese Americans, Vietnamese Americans, Korean Americans and other Oriental Americans who have felt the heavy hand of communist oppression. Since each and every one of these nationalities are fighting the same destructive enemy, the Zionist/Bolshevik, communist/socialist, Jews, it would be more effective if all joined hands in a cooperative effort. I might add that leading the fight against the Zionist Jews should be the pro-American Jews, like myself, who love America and realize the destruction the New York/Moscow/Tel Aviv has brought to the world. A holy land state. Since the land now occupied by Israel is rightly referred to as the Holy Land, all Christians, Muslims, and anti-Zionist Jews should cooperate in an effort to transform Israel into a demilitarized Holy Land state under international supervision. Then, from this Holy Land could come the Word of God instead of torture, war and drugs. The real issue. I want to emphasize a key point of this book. It is a waste of time to talk about fighting communism and the problems it has caused, and it is a waste of time to talk about the international problems facing America unless the main cause of those problems has been identified. The cause, of course, is the Zionist-oriented Jewish international bankers and their Zionist Jews who operate behind a cloak of secrecy,